Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
This is Noah Weil with the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. I'm joined by two guests today, Denise Gagne and Eric Reisner.
Hi.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Thought we'd do a little bit different, try the double guest format, see how it sounds.
Menage a pod.
I'll just briefly introduce my guests. Denise Gagne is a former assistant city attorney with the city of Seattle, now a well-renowned defense lawyer in Seattle. And Eric Reisner, you have not been on the show before, so I'd like to have my guests just talk about some of their trial work, some of the cases they presided over, you know, important legal stuff they've done.
Sure. So I was the prosecuting attorney in Kramer versus Kramer, and I don't know, they made a documentary out of it. I don't know if you saw it.
Never heard of it. Not familiar with it.
Were you played by Dustin Hoffman?
Well, no. I was Dustin Hoffman. He was the...
Your client?
No, he was the other side, I think.
He was the Kramer, not the Kramer.
Yeah. I was going to try John Wilkes Booth before that went south. So, yeah, I've been around for a little while. I've had a couple of big cases.
Couple high profile. No big deal.
But mostly retired at this point. I worked with Johnny Cochran on the OJ trial as well.
Wow.
Yeah. I was a backup. I don't know if you could
like
see me
sometimes.
You were
like a consultant, right?
Yeah.
Where were you?
Okay. Yeah. And then me and Ito would go out for drinks afterwards sometimes. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, oh, man, he was a party. He was a maniac. It was unbelievable.
So it's not clear yet. You've had no legal training or any education, really.
Both of these things are true.
In the profession, we refer to you as a muggle or a normie or a peasant.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be fun to have somebody who is basically
watches TV.
Yeah, basically a deviant off the street and ask them questions about the legal system and see how they respond to those questions.
Okay, this will be like a... Jeopardy. I knew I was out of my depth here. All right, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, you can hit me.
There's no Jeopardy. We're just having a conversation. We're just having some fun.
Or double Jeopardy.
Yeah. Final Jeopardy.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, we can do that.
Okay.
That sounds fine.
Great. I mean, you're in the booth. The door is locked. There's no there's no leaving until the show is done.
Yeah. It's good you strapped me to the chair as well.
I do that for all my guests.
Yeah.
Some like it more than others.
Well, yeah, it's like when you hold a baby or a dog, right? You squeeze them like it.
Swaddle.
If they're talking too much, give them a little shake just to let them know. Yeah. Calm down.
And then a little slap.
Yeah. Slow down. So, Eric, I'm curious. Since you came from a small town in Washington,
yes.
What were your thoughts on the police growing up?
I had a couple of minor run-ins, but by and large, like, we were just like, cops are cool, cops are our buds. Like, we never had any problem with the cops, but we were all a bunch of little crackers running around in a cracker town. So,
what was your cracker town?
Hoquiam, Washington.
Wow.
Aberdeen. It's next to Aberdeen. Do you know Aberdeen?
Nope.
Kurt Cobain?
Yes.
Okay. Now it's just meth. It's all just meth at this point.
Well, I can see it in your teeth.
Now, okay, no, that's not true. It would be a cute little town if it weren't so like immensely poor, and the people there just completely lost all hope. So it's pretty sad going back. Can I go cry now, or
if you want to?
So no, we never had. You know, the cops were cool. the times that I did run into the cops, you know, when you're a teenager, like, it's one of those things where it's just like, all right, go stop being a stupid 15-year-old and, you know, get on home. So
it felt like they weren't targeting minorities or...
Were they minorities?
What's a minority?
Yeah.
We did have a couple of black kids in class, and that was like a novelty. That was pretty cool. We were like, whoa. And then I remember when I went to middle school and there was Morgan Chang. He was like the first Asian. We're like, whoa, Asian. So that's the kind of town we're from.
So were the three minorities in your community targeted at all, or did everybody just?
Not that I know of. I mean, we never. Yeah.
So it was just like a public resource, like the fire department or something. If it came up, you might interact with them, but it wasn't omnipresent or anything.
Oh, no, certainly not. Yeah.
Where did you grow up, Denise?
I grew up in a poor farming community in eastern Washington called Burbank. And I think our police force had two officers, Buck and Cletus.
No.
I'm sure urban legend, but I grew up just knowing, like, in the sense that you know things at 17.
That his name was Cletus?
Buck and Cletus. And then Buck had grown up in that same small town and had been bullied quite severely. And that this is all, I'm sure, urban legend. But everybody in my town knew the story that Buck, one day, the kid who bullied him all through and tormented him through middle school and high school, he pulled him over once. And that kid, I don't remember what that kid's name is, said, "You got to be kidding me, Buck. Expletives, expletives." Grabbed Buck's handcuffs and handcuffed Buck to his own car and then drove away. So again, I'm sure there's no part of the story that is actual, but everybody who I grew up with knew this about.
That story did not end how I thought it would end.
No, yeah. I thought the bully would become the, yeah.
No.
All right, well, good for Buck.
Did you have any thoughts on police growing up, aside from they were completely incompetent or...
I was pulled over before the age of 25 10 different times for speeding or turning the wrong way. I never actually got a ticket. So I just grew up with, you know, even in a poor white community, the privilege of being a hot, young, blonde, white chick.
And crying a lot, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, the crying and the cleavage and all of that always helps.
We know how it goes, yeah. It's good legal advice, I think, mm-hmm. for the young female listeners.
Exactly.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah.
It's good advice for the young male listeners, too. Put away your pride and just, you know, do what you got to do.
I guess I can say
you don't want that stuff on your record.
From personal experience, crying sometimes works. Cleavage is less effective.
Oh. I was talking about going, like, the full.
Oh, okay. Just.
Yeah.
That belt looks so tight on you.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I help you with that? Yeah.
You look uncomfortable, officer.
Yeah.
Let me help.
Yeah.
It's warmer in this car if you're.
Oh, my back seat is huge. If the seats go down. Yeah. Yep.
I don't think I can publish anything we've done so far. Just Zippo.
I was going to make some cop jokes earlier, but I didn't want to come up on them. Okay, so, yeah. No, cops are cool. And I still have I know that there are, you know, bad seeds and whatever and stuff, but, like, I am not afraid of the cops. Like, as I, you know, stroll through the streets of Seattle, like, I have no, like, I don't feel one way or the other, right? I don't feel like I'm nervous or whatever. I remember there was one time I was dating, Sam, an ex-girlfriend. She's from South Africa, and she moved up here long time ago, and we were driving down to Aberdeen. We're on I-5, and I like to get where I'm going, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I've been in the car with you.
And
yeah.
So we were going down the freeway, and then, you know, sirens, lights come on, and so we get pulled over, and she is, like, just apoplectic. She's really upset because, you know, we're going to pull. I'm like, what's the problem? Like, we're going to be cordial, and we're going to, you know, be, like, nice, whatever. And she's like, I hate cops. I hate cops so much. Like, this, it's really stressing me out. Like, we're getting pulled over. Comes up, didn't get a ticket. He's just like, slow it down, whatever. Right, go back. All right, fine. She's still just like, she's just tilted, like, the rest of the afternoon because we got pulled over. And I'm like, what's the problem with cops? Like, who cares? Like, whatever. Just be nice and nothing's going to happen. And she's like, you don't understand. I grew up in South Africa. like the cops down there are just complete assholes.
Super corrupt.
Yeah, super corrupt. And even, I mean, she's white, and even she was just like, no, I want no part of the cops whatsoever. Like, it would, it really put her in a bad space for the whole rest of the afternoon. But and it was one of the, this was a long time ago, and it was one of the first like indications that they like not that they could screw up their job because everyone's bad at their job, but that they could like be actively like
malevolent.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, I'm going to abuse this power. Like, it never occurred to me that, like, oh, someone might actually abuse this power that they've been given.
It never occurred to me the power of life and death and imprisonment and stealing all your possessions could be abused.
Right, yeah.
And that's so sweet. You should be a police officer.
This reminds me of another thing. Can we change topics slightly?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you remember when you were a kid and you watched Star Wars, right? And then, like, you would see Obi-Wan Kenobi and he would be like, these aren't the droids you're looking for, right?
Star... What was it?
Oh God, get out of
Trek.
Here! You're the biggest nerd. I don't know where you land on this, but this guy. So okay, so Obi-Wan Kenobi would be like, you know, Jedi mind trick, like, you know, these aren't the droids you're looking for, or whatever. And so you think about it, and you're like, oh, okay, you don't really think about like how problematic that might be, right? So okay, fine. And then there's other things that do this, like there's the Preacher comic, and he kind of controls people's minds and stuff. You don't really think about it, but then when you see it in the hands of a bad guy, so this Jessica Jones show came on,
yeah.
Bad guy can control minds, right? And it never occurred to me, like, when you watch Jedi, how powerful this ability is, where you're just like, that person can't live. Like, you would have, like, if you had that kind of power, like, you'd just be like, you know, go do this for me, do this and stuff. Like,
yeah,
and so you don't think about how power, like, absolutely wrecks even the best people. Because even Jedis would just be like, orgy time, round them up, right? Like you wouldn't be able to escape that.
Have you seen Jessica Jones?
I have not.
Okay. Well, there is, Eric's right. There's a character in there that has absolute mind control power, and the people know what they're doing, but they can't stop themselves. And so he's like, cut off your nose. And they're like, okay. And he just cuts them off. Walk into traffic. Okay. Throw your baby off a cliff. Yes, I'll do that. I know. It's really grim. And yeah, it's in some ways, it is more powerful or despair-inducing or it generates more feelings than like some robot that could, you know, pick up the Empire State Building and throw it to the moon. Like, that's kind of like abstract power, but this is really like, it's like rape, you know, it's just like, you have no control. It's, yeah, it's very nasty.
Is this a comic or a television show?
Yeah, it used to be a comic, and now it became a Netflix live action show.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's good television, but yeah, it's powerful.
But I imagine that dealing with cops is something similar, right? Where they're just like, they can tell you to do something and you are almost obliged to do that, right?
Yeah, well...
I mean, to a point.
Well, I'll tell you two things. The first thing is, in Star Wars, we all watched that scene, but then Jabba was like, oh, you're so weak-willed. Of course, you get tricked by this Jedi thing.
Oh,
it doesn't
yeah.
work on me.
Right.
And so everybody watched was like,
yeah.
I am much too strong in the Force,
yeah,
or I am much too strong-willed. I would not be tricked by this.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, there's like that substitution. But, yeah, there's been tons of stories about police officers. Not like all police officers, obviously, but there have been stories about police officers who, especially young women, would be like, hey, I'm going to give you a ticket, or you can perform the sex act on me. By the way, you don't have a choice. I have a gun and handcuffs. You're going to perform the sex act on me.
Really?
Yes. Denise, you've heard of these things happening? It's rare, but it happens.
That seems, I mean, in America?
Yeah.
No, I sound totally naive. I knew this was going to happen. And like, God, you sound like such a dunce. Like,
yes,
really?
It happens. I mean, yeah, it totally has happened.
Like the police officer who was just convicted of 9 counts of rape for specifically targeting poor African-American women and forcing them into sex acts.
Yeah.
I don't think, again, I don't think that that's
it's not
common.
It's not common.
Of course
I don't think
not.
That
no.
most officers do that. But there are...
And it's not like a police-specific thing. There could be janitors, there could be executives, bankers who rape women. You know, it's not like, oh, police are the worst people. But I think you're right. I think having that power to command people to do things is a concern.
Yeah,
it can happen. You know, we have a mutual friend who posted this article about how if you are being unlawfully resisted or unlawfully arrested, you should violently, but not too much violence, resist arrest because it's unlawful.
No.
Yeah.
That sounds like terrible advice.
It is terrible advice.
Okay.
I jumped in there. I was like, you're going to get killed if you do that. You will actively get killed. Go to jail, work it out.
Yeah.
But But yeah, that's the concern. If the police are violating the law against you, if they are arresting you because you're black or because you mouthed off or something, totally legal things to be and do, but if they are putting you in jail, you don't have the capability to resist. Maybe legally you could try to make that argument, but the fact is they're just going to arrest you harder and it's going to go worse.
Right.
And I don't know, what do you think, Denise, about this entity? Is it a fair trade for society? We've got this police force, it keeps us safe, stops crime, but we also have this entity that if they want to do bad things to you, you kind of can't stop them. You're going to have to let it happen.
I think we need police force. I think that there's a huge public safety component that they provide, and I feel safe knowing that I can dial 911 and I'll receive, hopefully, fairly immediate aid. But with that benefit comes the potential risk of that power being abused. And I don't know that it's a, I want to call it a necessary evil, but I think it's just the reality of a police force existing means there's an opportunity for officers to take advantage of their power. I don't think it's common. I don't think it's, I don't want to be disrespectful to police because even as a defense attorney,
because
I do.
Because they have guns.
But
as Noah touched on earlier, he said that this kind of corruption of power can and does happen at every level, even like as you're someone's doctor, or you're someone's, you know, like a mortgage officer or whatever. Right?
I heard a horrible story about a dentist who would sexually abuse his patients when they were under anesthesia.
Right.
Yeah.
So if I can, you know, offer you a really good mortgage rate for a little fellatio, or like I can diddle you when you're knocked out as a dentist. Like, so these things are happening. Why is it that we are so enamored with these stories coming out of police? Like, why is this the one area of power and control that we've decided that we're really, really interested in, you know, hearing stories about this, or maybe getting to the bottom of it, or ferreting these people out or whatever, right? Is it because it's more common, or because we come into contact with police more, or we're more afraid of what they could do and we're not afraid of our orthodontist? Like,
I think it's a good question. I have some ideas, but Denise, do you want to?
I think it's because of their tie to the government, that even there are things about priests, right? I mean, that is a salacious story and that's sold over and over, but it's something that you can sort of push off to the side. And if you're not Catholic and you don't think of yourself as being at risk for that happening to you, because it's a choice that people go to a particular church, it's a choice that people go to an orthodontist, it's a choice that people go see an investment banker, and you can sort of detach yourself in some ways. But with officers, they're an arm of the government. They're someone who you don't necessarily have a choice coming into contact with. If you leave your house and if you're walking on a public sidewalk, there is an opportunity for you to come in contact with this branch of the government. And I think it hits at a core of who Americans, or what Americans think is most important, is the government being fair and the government being tasked with protecting the citizens. So when there are police officers who are violating that confidence, it becomes a huge concern.
Mm-hmm.
Noah, what do you think?
Well, I do agree with all those things. I think doctors, those stories will get a lot of play too, because that is kind of the same thing in the sense that we entrust ourselves and our lives to these people, and to have that complete submission abused is really just like a personal offensive thing. If your doctor is doing terrible things to you when you're under anesthesia, that's awful. Like, that's everyone's nightmare, having a sponge sewed into them or something more volitional. It's just like, yeah, when your doctor doesn't do the right thing, that's a fear that everybody has. With police, I do agree with the government thing, and it's a service industry, theoretically. And so, again, these people that are there to serve the public, completely, not just not serving the public, but taking advantage of the public, I think is really offensive. And I also think there was this, I wouldn't say propaganda, but there was a lot of rhetoric back in the day about police are our friends, officer friendly, from, you know, school, from DARE programs, and just this cognitive dissonance of these people who were kind of this higher entity are a different entity, a lower entity, at least as far as these stories are concerned, and people like kind of reconciling those two concepts. And that's a conversation that's continually ongoing in our society, just the role of police and what they actually do and what they should be doing and things like that.
That feels like a false sheen that was laid on stuff, though. I mean, maybe that was true in, like, you know, a small town in Oklahoma or whatever, right? But I feel like as far as police corruption, we are, like, it's just better and better, right? Like, we are so far away from where it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago because it, like, I'm kind of talking off the cuff here. I haven't really thought about this before, but, like, it seems, like, because they're, ostensibly, they're not in cahoots with the mafia anymore or whatever, right? And there is more opportunities for, like, people are braver about calling out stuff like this, right? Where before, maybe you wouldn't necessarily, right? Because you had no recourse. You had no place to go to, necessarily. And I don't know. I mean, is my sense of things correct or incorrect? Because I feel like, on the whole, cops are just, like, better than they were some time ago.
So I appreciate you saying, first of all, that you haven't studied it, because one of the reasons you're on the program is to represent the uneducated, knuckle-dragging everyman.
Yep, yeah.
So,
caveman
again,
lawyers.
Yeah, so your perspective is really appreciated here.
It sounds like it. Hey, dummy, talking to the microphone. Yeah. Say stupid shit
the
and
mic's,
then we'll,
the mic's
we'll
over
swat
here.
You down and down. Yeah.
No. I think you're right. I think the idea of the companies or the mafia buying the police department is kind of a relic. But I also think that's not the whole picture. If you look at the media, you look at television shows or movies, you know, the police were almost always the good guys. There were some exceptions, but they were like, there was this very good guy, bad guy dichotomy.
Oh, sure. In media culture and stuff, right?
Yeah, but that propagates throughout our culture. That's become,
but I guess,
but hold on.
Okay.
But I think, you know, especially with the cell phone cameras, things like that, when people can see a police officer, you know, shooting an unarmed person or somebody running away, which has also made the news lately. The idea in the past that a police officer would shoot somebody that doesn't deserve it, it's just kind of anathema. It's just like, if someone's getting shot, it's because they did something really violent and really immediate against a police officer. And the police officer feared for their lives.
So you think they're more trigger happy now than they were before?
I don't know if they are more trigger happy now, but I think people are becoming more aware of when guns are fired, and that's not always done correctly.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I specifically in regards to minorities, like, this is going to sound so stupid. I can't believe I'm going to say this. Would you rather be black now and deal with a cop, or be black 40 years ago and deal with a cop? Like shit's bad right now. I'm pretty sure it was worse for them back then, right?
Yeah, you're right. That is a terrible question.
Okay.
Just the dumbest thing.
I know. That is, and everyone's going to read into, like, well, is it solved? No, shut up. Like, don't read more into that thing than what I said. Stop it, you guys. But
my speculation is that the Civil Rights Act has done a lot for minority relations and minority empowerment in this country. And 40 years ago, things were a lot worse. And I think everybody would agree, when things were more segregated and it was more overt racism, that was really bad.
Okay. Specifically, what I'm asking is that, didn't cops feel more free to do whatever the fuck they wanted to then versus now? That's specific.
Yeah.
That's really what
we can go
what
40
I'm...
years more back and go into, like, the strike breakers and, you know, the shootings in the street. Sure.
Oh, yeah.
I agree, but we can't say things are better now. We can say now we have more understanding of the intricacies of society and how things interplay and the subtle, more subtle, pervasive effects of institutional racism versus just overt displays of it. And to say, yes, things are better now, I think is true, but it also, we have a better understanding of how things are connected. And it's just kind of a different issue too. It's better, but it's still, there's such a long way to go. And now we understand more about how much work we still have to do.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the ability for people to call out behavior like this, you know, digitally, like the ease of that now is, I feel like everything kind of like creaks along, and then it hits a point and then it just goes whoosh, like really fast and it solves itself or it, you know, gets obliterated or whatever. Right. Like, I feel like we're at that point where it's just like, this is a thing where, like, these people, like, if you're on the police force and you think Bob has a little bit of a, you know, an inclination to go a beaten, or whatever, right? Like you're not going to tolerate that. Like the police headquarters are they're going to get rid of these people pronto, right? And not allow this shit anymore. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like we're at this point where of course it's not going to get solved completely, but I feel like the percentage is going to be so low that maybe it just won't matter anymore.
I want to go back and answer the question you asked before. I think that what minorities are facing conflict with the police force, I don't think it's necessarily gotten better, but I think it's changed. Mm-hmm. I think 40 years ago that police officers would probably feel completely entitled to walk into the private home residence of a location where a black man was having consensual sex with a white woman and perhaps abusing that person, right? I think now what a minority can look forward to is having a officer come into their home, not for that specific issue, which is changing somewhat, but hasn't totally changed, mm-hmm. but they can look forward to having an officer come into their home if they happen to be a minority who has withdrawn too much cash from their bank account, if they're a minority who lives in a nice neighborhood and doesn't appear as the other neighbors do. I think that it's in some respects gotten better, but I don't think it's changed all that drastically, mm-hmm. actually.
Yeah.
And now I forgot what your second question was, because I also had brilliant insight into how I wanted to answer that. But
that's why you're here.
Yes. Oh, I think what the question, your second question was, won't these people just be taken care of? Won't the bad officers just be...
Won't this get ferreted out? Because, I mean, not only because of just, you know, conscience, but because of, like, bad PR, right? They're just like, we can't deal with this. We don't want any part of these people that are going, that we suspect or we think that are going to get, like, you know, like the guy that dragged the teenage girl across the lawn, right, and like sat on her and stuff a few months ago, right? Like that guy shouldn't have a job ever again. And you know, I suspect that wasn't the first time that he was, you know, a complete prick, and you know that they tribe up and be like, take care of their own, like isn't very helpful. It seems like they would just be like, no, we can't deal with you being around. Like it's just bad for everyone all around.
The individual officers may think that. I think one of the problems is the power of the police unions. And I think there have been several recent incidents with the Seattle Police Department. One was Officer Whitlatch, who lost her job, and she's appealing it. And just sort of the scuttlebutt I hear internally from some of the officers is that it's likely she will get her job back in arbitration. There's another Officer Adley Shepard, who punched a woman who in the back of a patrol car who was handcuffed and who was clearly intoxicated. And as he was struggling to get her in, she kicked at him and he punched her in the face and he broke her orbital socket. And he has been on paid administrative leave for coming up almost on 2 years. OPA, wow. The Office of Public Accountability, made a recommendation that he not be brought back onto the force. It will be up to the chief right now, Chief O'Toole, whether or not to accept OPA's recommendation. Even if she does fire him, he's still protected by the police union, and he has rights based on his contract mm-hmm. with the police department. And many on the force believe that he likely will eventually have his job back. The reality is, he's been on paid leave for close to 2 years. I don't think that necessarily his case is entirely like some of these other ones. Officer Shepard happens to be African-American. The woman who he punched happens to be African-American. But I think I use that as an example only to say that my sense is police unions are very, very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And that even when there is a overt act of abuse of power, the bottom line for the union is to protect its own.
Sure.
And that means standing up for even people who've done unconscionable things.
No matter what they do, they will always say they should get their jobs.
So do you think that, in your opinion then, these, like the two officers that you talked about, should they be allowed to be back onto the force? Or some hypothetical case like this, right? And maybe not, you don't want to speak to those specifically, right? But you know, cop does something untoward, you know, just abuses their power a little bit, like knocks someone around a little bit. Like, should they be given a chance to get back onto the force?
I think everybody should be given a chance. I do believe that due process exists even for corrupt officers. But okay. I think that these, what should be neutral agencies like the Office of Public Accountability should carry very significant weight in what happens with that officer.
Sure.
And I don't think most of the officers in Seattle would believe that OPA is an unbiased organization. I think most of the officers mm-hmm. themselves would feel that OPA is
right,
highly biased against SPD. But ideally, there would exist in each community an organization that would take a neutral look at what the allegations are. And I do think that being an officer is really fucking hard. And I think that they're required to make split decisions each and every day that civilians can't even fathom.
Sure.
But if there's a neutral agency that can look at the facts, can investigate it, and then can make a recommendation to the chief, I do think that is a better way to handle it than just to have the matter handled completely internally.
Sure, of course.
I think that you are overestimating how likely the other members of the force will chime in for somebody's firing or resignation. I think some will, but I also think
sure.
these are people you rely on for your life, literally, and you might screw up sometime and you want them to have your back. And
right.
no
and
one
call
likes,
out one.
No one likes a tattletale.
Yeah.
No one likes a snitch.
Sure.
And, you know, the sergeants, the lieutenants, they have to keep their men and women in order. And if they start isolating people or saying your job's not safe and I don't have your back, that's going to create problems down the road.
Right.
I think there's a lot of competing resources. I think if everybody was very community driven, whatever's best for the city is what we should do. And, you know, you can have some honest conversations about what is best for the city for an individual officer's conduct. But if everybody had that motivation, I think things would be simpler. But I think things are a little more attenuated. The guild only cares about officers. The officer cares primarily about himself or herself and his career, which is understandable. I would feel the same way. But that kind of submission to the greater good, it's not realistic. And so I think Denise is right. I think having that division of authority, everyone can have their input, but who really makes the decisions, it's important for them to be as neutral as possible.
Sure.
And I don't think that's the case right now.
So then it's especially important for the citizenry to be the ones that are calling this stuff out then, because
yeah.
they're the only ones that have any kind of
power. And even then, there's some bias.
Sure.
Well, I mean, not just like the anti-police bias. I mean,
okay.
the woman who was punched has a really good civil lawsuit against
mm-hmm.
the police officers. And so it behooves her to find that the officers find there is misconduct and that the officer did not act appropriately, because that's an easy settlement to be made.
Right.
And so, again, you've got a lot of different competing interests, and it's a tough situation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't blame almost anyone for advocating for their own position as well as possible, but I think it does do a detriment to the city itself when you have all these competing interests.
Sure, of course.
It's tough. So, moving on to another topic.
Yeah.
Eric.
Shit got heavy real quick.
This is what we do all the time. We're always talking about what's best for the city and really heavy stuff. You know, we just go home and cry to our spouses.
Yeah. I was just hoping to talk about, like, kettle corn or something.
Okay.
Did you come in with your own list? I hear that you had questions you wanted to ask.
Oh, I did have. Well, I had some questions about that. Because one of the things that I noted when Noah started this podcast, he just jumped right into something. He jumped right into a topic, and he never, like, introduced himself and never gave any kind of, like, hey, this is me and this is
Hi,
what I'm doing.
I'm Noah.
But so I had a
What's
few
up,
questions
y'all?
For him. But I'm glad that you're here. I didn't know that you were going to be here. And so maybe this is something for a different time, and then I can do a little a Q&A with you and, like, get to know this Noah, but for now we should do something that's a little more.
We can do whatever, all the time in the world.
I mean, you're strapped to the chair, but this is a flexible sort of format.
Yes. Okay. Well, I can come back. We can be strapped another time. How about we do it kind of at the same? Well, no, because I think on your podcast you kind of went.
We're going so meta here.
Well, you asked her questions about, like, you know, why did you go into blah blah blah. Blah, blah. This is a long time ago I listened to it, but is that my recollection correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So So let's do it another time. What are your other questions? Hit me with your other stuff. What do you got? I'll be your jester. Let's do it.
Death penalty. What are your thoughts on it?
Love it. Hate it. Want it.
More deaths. Less deaths. Amount of deaths.
I've certainly dreamt about sentencing certain people to it.
Like people who make your parking situation difficult.
Oh my God. Yeah. Hey, University of Washington, do you have to spread out all over the place and make everything like permit parking only? You can't make just normal parking.
Right. Okay. Death was it?
Death.
Yes.
I like death.
Death to all dorks.
Death's a lot lighter.
Death to nerds.
How do you feel about the death penalty in our country?
It's one of those things that I vacillate on. I think I have reached the point where it is worth the, because so part of the reason that you would kill somebody is that it might be cheaper to execute them than to just like let them. I know this. Yeah, she's shaking her head like don't. Yeah, because of the appeals and everything. I understand. But I think even the risk of like, oh, you know, 5 years later, oops, like is probably worth not having it. But I appreciate the kind of, the therapy and the finality that a certain group of people or the, you know, the victim's family or whatever it was, like that they get out of that. I do think there's actual value there because, you know, someone is going to get something out of seeing this person, you know, taken care of, as it were. But I think if a person is, you know, is wrongly accused and convicted, I think it's better for them just to, you know, let them rot in jail and they can read, you know, War and Peace and get buff, and instead of just like, you know, offing them. So
Tolstoy is not allowed in our prison system.
Oh, no Tolstoy?
No, there's a little...
No Huck Finn either.
The legislator.
That's too bad. I started it, I never finished it.
Yeah, it's a big book.
Yeah.
I also failed to finish it.
What made you, you said you vacillated somewhat, what's made you kind of go back and forth and change opinions?
I don't know. Soften up as you get older, I suppose. Like even rewinding a little bit, I was of the mind that, like, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past before, where if you are at, pardon me, if you are at the police station, or if a cop has stopped you, or if you're in some kind of, like, thing, right?
This is going to be our next topic.
Yeah. You're there for a reason. Like, there is no circumstance, like, before, and I've softened a little bit on this, but I still kind of believe it in most cases. There's no circumstance under which you are just in jail because, you know, like, you're shaggy and it wasn't me. Like, it was just, you just got the, like, the wrong person, right? Like, it's just like, if you're not there for that thing, you're there for something else maybe that they don't know about, right? Like they say about Nixon, right? Like, he, you know, everyone did all this stuff before, he just got caught, right? And so maybe you just got caught this one time, but you did a bunch of other whatever before, right? Because, like if you're there, there's some reason that you're there, right? And so if it was like, well, if you're on, like, and there are so many doors before that you have to go through before you get to, now you're on the electric chair, that if you've gotten this far, yeah, you probably deserve it. Like, there's something, you know, you probably, whatever.
Just the collective weight of your sins, even if you didn't actually strangle that child. Just like all the things you stole from mom's purse when you were five.
No, but specifically in the, you know, as it applies to the death penalty, like, my assumption is that, you know, there's so much due diligence on at every step where it's just like, it was an utter impossibility to me that someone could get this far in the process and then afterwards they would be like, you know, going through some evidence or whatever and be like, oh, Joe, look at this. I think we got the wrong guy. Like, and, you know, and I know that's happened or whatever, but like, but even on the initial like contact, right. It's like, you know, if maybe they'll stop you and maybe they'll talk to you or whatever. Right. But like, if you have been booked or if you have like, now you've spent a couple of months in jail, like, you're not just spending a couple of months in jail because of, you know, blah, right? And I know that that is a little naive.
Well, it's funny to me because one of your life philosophies, as I've known you for a while, and actually this is one I've adopted, is most people are bad at their jobs. But you think lawyers are exempt from that, that all the trial lawyers and all the appeals lawyers.
I think
that
most people are bad at their jobs, but I'm an eternal optimist. And I know this doesn't make a lot of sense. But I still think that I'm just like, everything will work out. Like, everything, like, it'll be fine. Like, everything will be fine, right? That's just always my kind of philosophy about everything. I'm just like, it'll work. It'll be all right. And so far, so good. But, like, yeah, I think, you know, people are bad at their job, but... But I think you have to. I think you have to assume that everyone's good at their job until they give you a reason to think otherwise, right? It's just like I've had a lot of stuff stolen from me in my life professionally from doing games and cards and stuff. And like, but every time I'm just like, I can leave this sitting here, like nothing's gonna happen, it'll be fine, right? And I still kind of think that way. Yes, people are bad at their job, but they're not like. Deliberately bad, right? And and I trust the cops, and I trust my doctors not to put a sponge in me, and I trust, you know, all these people. Because you have to. Because if you didn't, you'd go insane. Like, if you had to deal with all these professional people that knew a bunch of, that knew a lot more about this arena than you did, right? And you just didn't trust what they were saying each time, like, you'd lose your mind, right? Like, you'd come and talk to your lawyer about such and such thing, and you'd go to your doctor afterwards, and then you'd talk to, you know, I have to go and get a visa later today, right? And I hope she knows what she's doing, because if she doesn't, like, I'm not going to get my visa, right? And so on and so forth. So, like, you'd go nuts. It'd be an impossible life to live if you didn't trust the people in authority and just assume at the outset that they're, you know, capable and know how to do their job. Because even if they screw up, like, the system is in place to make it so that it's really hard to screw up, right? So you're just like, it'll work out.
So, you know, Denise was gesturing wildly when you talked about cheaper to execute than to put him in prison.
Right.
But this is kind of like the issue. You have all these checks and balances because somebody might screw up along the line, but those checks add a lot of cost and a lot of time to the process. Assuming an execution goes through, I think it's like a decade at least. I mean, it can be much more until someone is actually executed when the jury says he should be put to death, and then the person is put to death.
Right.
Right. So... is that a good trade that we have all these checks and these double checks and extra eyes looking at the case before the person can be executed just to avoid the potential somebody who did screw up on their job getting away with it?
Probably.
Even though it adds a lot of cost and time?
Yeah, probably. Although I do see, like, so I've went and watched you a few times and I've seen stuff, you know, before and after, and I've been to court for, you know, speeding tickets and stuff. And like,
you have some pending arson charges too right now, right?
Shh. What the hell, man? Unbelievable.
Sorry, hot topic. I know.
Remember how you said everyone's bad at their job?
No.
Jesus.
I talk too much when the mic comes on.
I can't believe it.
I'm just ready.
But I do see what appears to me to be a lot of just petty shit where I'm just like, really? Are we really paying like a lawyer way too much and a judge way too much to like deal with this horse shit all the time?
I don't think they pay enough, but yeah, I agree with you on the judges.
Oh, you're probably overpaying. Yeah. But I see this, I'm just like, what are we doing? And I think if I was in it day to day and I, like you guys, I would probably lose my fucking mind because of how petty all this, like a lot of this stuff seems to me, and that we're dealing with all this stuff is, I don't know. What was the original?
Is it good that we have checks and balances?
I mean, it's better than just having, you know, the old judge, jury, and executioner song. But like, so yes, I guess. I mean, if this is what we're going to spend our time on, great. But I don't know. You know, I had a really interesting. I don't know if Noah told you, but I was in Europe all this last year, and I was in Serbia for a while, and this is tangentially connected, but it's a good story. And I was walking along a street, and I was in Belgrade, Serbia, and I see all of these vans and cars with their backs open, right? And there's just books, like just tons of books. There's just van after van after van on this street and car, and they all are open. They have the books open, right? And I see kids and parents and stuff, and they're all like rummaging through these books and whatever. And I was like, what is going on? So I stopped and asked this kid. He was standing over there. He's like 16. And I said, what are they doing over here? And he said, well, we're buying our books for school, for, you know, like high school and junior high and everything. And I was like, but the state doesn't, like, they don't give you books. He's like, no. Like, starting from, you know, age zero, like, you have to buy your own books to go to school and everything, right? Like so here in the United States, you have to buy your own books for college, and it's a total beating. But, like, for high school and everything, they give you the books, right? But there, you have to buy your own books all the time. And he's like, yeah, and it's expensive, and it sucks, and we don't like it. And so we started talking about other stuff, and he mentioned something that was very interesting to me more strongly suggested what I'd kind of heard echoed from other people before in this area, in Croatia and Serbia, these, you know, former communist countries, is that, you know, he's like, we don't like democracy. Like, we don't like the system that we have right now because our economy's bad. Like, everybody's poor. Like, it just kind of sucks here. Like, there's just as much corruption as before. But at least before, we kind of knew what was up, and we had... specifically he said, we want a strong, what you call dictator. Like, we just want some one person who will just be like the guy and just be, you know, make decisions and be strong and do what, you know, like a benevolent dictator or whatever, right? And like, it was a little mind blowing to hear as an American, because you're just like, what? No, you don't want that, right? And so I think there's, I think people, like the judge, jury, and executioner thing, I think this part of that is very attractive to people, right? Because it's just like, can I put this trust in you to make this decision? Yes? Okay. You're going to do it right? Yes. Okay, great. And then it'll cut out so much like paperwork and, you know, red tape and stuff. And I think there's something like very attractive to people about something like that. And I think it's why Putin is so popular in Russia, but that's a different topic. But and this was echoed, not at the level that we're talking about, but at the, you know, at the governmental level, like a lot of people said, they were just like, yeah, we don't like democracy. We just want like a person in charge. Right. And
as long as they're not corrupt and good at their job and benevolent and compassionate.
Right. Yeah. And it does.
I mean, that sounds great.
There have been examples of that in the past, but yes, it's so rare that it's almost, doesn't matter. But, yes, do I think, like, if we could just put, like, you know, like Neil deGrasse Tyson in charge of all, you know, executions or something, and just be like, all right, go and, you know, talk to these people and figure out whether they did it, and then, like, yeah, sure, fine. But, like, you know, I don't think there's anybody that's probably qualified to be able to do that.
Well, that's an interesting idea, Denise. Do you think that our current system of checks and balances and appeals and reviews is based on the idea that power shouldn't be centralized and that there should be these things, even though it makes everything more expensive and take longer? Do you think that's correct? Is that the philosophy behind it?
Yeah, I do think that's the philosophy behind it. I do think that's the philosophy behind it. I think that's based in our Constitution. I think that's why we have the legislative branch, the executive branch, and, you know,
yeah,
there's like a third or something.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of branches on the tree. Mm-hmm. But still, people have said over and over again, especially with death penalty stuff, that the process takes way too long and there's way too many appeals. And I think for death penalty, we can all agree we don't want to get it wrong. We want the people who deserve death, whomever that could be, to get it, and the people who don't deserve it should not be put to death. But the realism is it adds a lot of money and cost. And even for things like life in prison, that's pretty consequential for whoever's suffering it. Do you think our process does create too many roadblocks to justice being swift and sure?
I think it creates roadblocks to justice being swift, but I don't personally like the idea of justice being swift. And I have grown up and lived my entire life in Washington, and I think I have this sense of there being problems in other parts of the country that aren't present here. And I think that's a very snobby of me to just assume that, hey, most of the time we get it right in Seattle, right? We're a very educated community, and it's a very diverse, and we've got lots of smart people between Boeing and Microsoft and Amazon, and the juries probably don't suffer the same biases and the same problems that jurisdictions in other parts of the country do. So when I think about why it's important to have these checks and balances and why the appeals process is crucial, I'm always in my brain have this mental image of some other place, and that it's important that we have it for places like Mississippi and
Louisiana. She's talking about Alabama. She's talking about you, Alabama.
Yes.
I think she's talking about Hoquiam, actually.
Oh, yeah. And Hoquiam. Yeah.
So while I do think our system here has problems, and I see it in court, not infrequently.
You used to be a part of the problem.
I used to be a big part of the problem when I was an officer of the government. I used to charge people just for looking at me wrong. I would add additional charges to the complaint. Reckless endangerment, you jerk. The other way. So, I think it's really critical. But I recognize part of these why I think it's critical is these assumptions that I have about problems being elsewhere.
This reminds me of a thing that I thought was really interesting when I listened to the podcast that you two did before. How it seemed like prosecutors were the dark side, and then like you guys were the light side. Like it was very, and then like you did like this morality shift, and it was very fascinating. Like, is it really as like, are there philosophies just fundamentally different than like in those two professions? Like how, like, is it really that?
You know, my friend Paul was on a couple of weeks ago, uh-huh. and he's a prosecutor. He's a current prosecutor. Uh-huh. And we talked about his work and why he was attracted to it. And we both agreed that we felt a calling to service, that he felt service to the victims, make sure they had a voice, and I felt a calling to people who were under the thumb of the government to make sure that their rights were protected. And I think in that regard, there aren't that many differences. But I also think, I guess in my experience, you know, Denise might have her own opinions, but I think in my experience, a lot of prosecutors, not all, but a lot of prosecutors have kind of a more rigid sense of how important laws are. And like, there's no moral relativism. Like, I'm like, yeah, steal a loaf of bread to feed your family. I'm fine with that. And they're like, you went into a store with the intent to steal a loaf of bread.
Right.
We as a society cannot allow, you know, bread thieves to go unpunished. Maybe we should be donating more to charity and food banks. This wouldn't come up, but right now you broke the law and you need to accept a punishment for it. Maybe it's just community service hour or something, but we can't, you know, just like the importance of predictability in society.
Sure.
I think is really important for them. And I'm just like, let's look at the whole circumstances. What about this person's life? Why?
Yeah. Can I ask you a personal question, Denise?
Sure.
Have you ever been in a bit of trouble?
I've never been arrested, no.
Okay.
I've never been.
Okay. Because what I observe is that if you've been poor in your life, right, like if you've just been like, I'm fucking poor, right, like you have a lot more sympathy for maybe, you know, stealing a loaf of bread or like, or just like what it takes to be poor. And I think a lot of people that haven't been poor don't understand how goddamn expensive it is to be poor. But like, and so if you're just like, you know, like silver spoons your entire life, like you just don't have a lot of sympathy for these people. You're just like, go to work, do some stuff, whatever, right? And I was wondering if that was kind of the same thing for defense attorneys, where they were like, I got into a spot of trouble at one point, like maybe, you know, like I can understand other sides to these things that these people don't, because you were saying it's just like they're very rigid and stuff, right? Well, that tells me that they've never like encountered any other type of, they've never been on the other side of a situation like that before.
I mean, I grew up in a double wide trailer, and I grew up with addiction in the family. My mom and my brother were both in rehab at the same time. So I think my sense is most people at the core are good. I think people who make bad choices that bring them into contact with the law in general have some sort of difficulty you can point back to in their childhood, whether it's poverty, whether it's growing up abused, whether it's growing up around addiction. Mm-hmm. And so I do personally have a lot of compassion, even if I haven't myself been inside a jail cell, have a lot of compassion, I think, for the circumstances that likely bring most people, not everyone, there are some truly evil people out there, but I think most people at the core are good, want to do good, want to contribute to society, yeah, and that have roadblocks in their way. And if you can help get to the root of what those roadblocks are, and I think a lot of people think that attorneys are just trying to get their clients off on technicalities. And I think most defense attorneys want, sure, they don't want their client in jail, but they also want to make sure that their client doesn't repeat the behavior that brought them in contact. And I think most attorneys have conversations, even if they're difficult, with their clients about mental health issues or about addiction issues or about things that they can do outside of the legal system that will help just make their lives better
sure.
and more productive.
Yeah.
So to Eric's question, do you think there is a fundamental philosophical difference between a brunt of prosecutors or a brunt of defense attorneys?
I don't know if everybody starts out with a completely divergent philosophy, but I think once you're in that, you know, at the city attorney's office, I think there were plenty of reasonable people who had compassion. There were plenty of very, very liberal prosecutors who, when they were in law school, were on the social justice activity committees, who were writing for journals that, you know, advocated for services for poor poverty. But I think once you're entrenched in whatever line of work it is for a certain period of time, you sort of have to develop an allegiance to that philosophy. And that when you're in the lunchroom surrounded by 15 other prosecutors, it's sort of natural mm-hmm. that everyone sort of gravitates towards one view of the case or the law. And that when you're, I assume this happened, the Public Defender's Agency, when you guys would talk about cases, did you feel like everyone was aligned with their philosophies? Did you think there were...
Yeah, we would talk about tactical decisions, but as far as should this case be going to trial or whatever, I mean, you know, you defer to the attorney who's on the case or the client, but yeah, there's never like, maybe this person should, you know, accept their punishment or something. It was just, that was never uttered in there. That's not an issue
right.
at all.
Did you feel like there was a culture at the
yeah.
defender agency where you worked at? Where?
Yeah, it was very pro services and pro getting them back on their feet and seeing what we could do for that. We had social workers on staff to assist with that, and we were encouraged to take advantage of that and get them into contact with them if they were amenable. Some people weren't interested, and that's fine. But yeah, if there was an opportunity to give them some help along the way or after they were done with the process, we certainly were encouraged to do it, and we all felt they should get it.
I'll ask you a pointed question. Do you think all prosecutors are evil?
Present company excluded?
I'm a former.
No, but I think with their power of their office, they can do some really destructive things to people and their families. And I think it's just like the police thing. It's really hard to have that much power and wield it appropriately. And sometimes they swing one way too far, and sometimes they swing the other way too far. I don't want to live in a society where crimes are not prosecuted, and I appreciate that there is a check against that, which are the defense attorneys. But, you know, I think it's very hard for someone in a prosecutor position to sometimes look past the case number and see the person behind it and their life story. And that can lead to not evil things, but insensitive, for lack of better words, uncompassionate. And to me, that's scary, that lack of compassion leads to such results for people. And so it's a concern for me. But it's the same with the police, you know. You don't see a person, you see a suspect or somebody who's about to be arrested or a prisoner, you know, things like that. It probably does come back to the police. You have so much power over somebody's lives. How do you make sure that they retain their humanity and make sure the people they're interacting with also seem like a brother or sister and not just a part of your file?
Eric, before you knew Noah as a defense attorney, and I'm sure he's a very overbearing man, right? And I'm sure that he's just influenced your thought process on the law. Before you knew him as a defense attorney, did you have any sort of mental image of, you know, where the light was, whether it was with the prosecution side, whether it was with the defense side? Did you
might know the answer to that question? I mean, earlier I talked about my sense of, like, if you're sitting in that chair, you're probably there for a reason, blah, 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 blah. Like, so that might tell you where my allegiances lie, if there were any. Like, it was honestly not a thing that I thought about very often because
right.
it didn't impact my life whatsoever. Like, I was a witness on, two things, but they didn't affect me ever, right? So, like I was not ever really connected to the process. But we kind of danced around a thing that that really bothers me and may bother other people. And I've always wanted to ask about this, and I guess I want both of your opinions because I we've talked about this before, but I want to hear what you have to say about it. You mentioned earlier that there is a sense that defense attorneys, like, their job is to just get their clients off on technicalities, da da da. And then you were saying stuff about, you know, the prosecuting attorneys being very, very linear in their thinking, very rigid and stuff. I'm not sure if other people feel the same way as I do, but my sense is, like, the frustration that I have with the process is that neither, like, why aren't both sides just trying to get to whatever the truth is and whatever the appropriate punishment is for this, like, this instance, right? So, because you do have this side pushing against this side, and then you're trying to find, like, well, the cop didn't cross his T on this form, and so throw it, like, do whatever, right? And, like, that's happening. And then you have the prosecutor that's just like, give him the book, like, do whatever I can, just like, da da da. Why aren't both sides, like, working to figure out, like, okay, let's just get to the core of what this thing is and then figure out what the appropriate penalty is for this thing? It kills me that you have two competing sides that are battling this way. Like, I fucking hate it. It really frustrates me that this is the situation because we've talked about this before, and I said, well, you know, something as simple as, like, well, did they do it, or do you think they're guilty? And then you're just like, it doesn't matter if I think they're guilty. Like, it doesn't matter if they did it or whatever. I'm like, no, that's all that matters, man. Like, that's all that's important. And if your job is to be like, well, you know, there weren't triplicates of this form, so what are you going to do? And then, the other guy's job is to be like, I don't know, whatever their thing is. And, like, what the fuck? How is this helping anybody when, like, why can't there just be a... I know this is very romantic, but, like, how can it not be, you know, just like, this is the truth. Like, let's just both get to whatever the truth is of this matter.
The truth of what happened in each case has a different impact for each person, and that reality is very unfair. So if I represent somebody, I'll just use DUIs as an example. If I represent a fluent person who's an executive at Amazon who's accused of a DUI, they did it. The impact that sentence is going to have on them is drastically different than what the impact will be for
sure.
Somebody who doesn't have the means to pay for an ignition interlock device, who doesn't have the means. So if person A, the person who's rich,
I appreciate
pleads,
that, but does that,
guilty,
does that give us license to treat this person less harshly than the other person for the same crime?
I think the disparity between how it impacts different people requires the process to fight.
Is that to say that the penalty, like, the baseline penalty for these things is too onerous, and we should loosen the penalties for all crimes because I don't want to see a system where one, whether it's the rich people get away with stuff and the poor people don't, or vice versa, where we're just like, hey, sorry, man, I want to see it meted out evenly across the board, right? And so I appreciate, like, where that comes from, but is that really helpful?
I'm going to answer that a couple things. There's a famous quote by a French philosopher, social scientist or something, that the law that prohibits people from sleeping under bridges affects the poor and the rich equally. Okay, with the implication that, yes, the law applies evenly, but the effect of it is very disparate.
Right.
And I've always... consider that, you know, the reality is laws affect people differently and punishments affect people differently. And I'm not sure I do want a system where that's not taken into account. But that's, you know, philosophical, that's fine. But, you know, a lot of my work is not looking for technicalities. It's kind of a part of it, but a lot of my work is talking with the prosecutor about what's the correct punishment. There is... some crimes do have really onerous punishments. DUIs have really, really onerous punishments. And telling a prosecutor, this is too much for somebody, here's what it should be instead, I can say that honestly, and they can say, I honestly believe differently.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you resolve that? Well, you go to trial, you go in front of a judge, do your thing. So I don't think the truth or what the correct result is necessarily some universal objective thing. I think people can have their own opinions on what happened. You get that with domestic violence all the time. Who pushed who first? You know, who got aggressive first?
Yeah.
People could have very different memories. You know, not even lying. They just remember it differently.
Oh, and, yeah, because in a situation like that, like, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's not like, let's figure this out together. It's like, who's more likely to be right? What can you prove at trial? A lot of the stuff does come down to what you can prove. There's many times where I'll have a case where I'll say, you didn't do this form correctly, and this and that, whatever, some what you'd call technicalities, but also, but we can come to a resolution if, you know, you can come down on your ask for jail time or something. So it's like, it's kind of a carrot and stick thing. We could come to a resolution, but if you don't, I've got some ammunition in the tank to fight it. Mm-hmm. And they feel the same way. Like, I can crush your witness. Your star witness has a million fraud convictions, and, you know, you got to come up a little bit because you can't win a trial. You know, we do a little posturing, but I think part of the process is looking at it from both sides. What is a fair result? But if we can't get there, how are we going to fight this out?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's never shown on TV, like, you know, here's what I've got, here's what you've got. But but that really is a lot of our jobs, is crafting this.
Sure. And I'm fine. That part seems reasonable and legit to me, where you're kind of going back and forth, and, you know, you're advocating. But the part where you're just like the technicality thing, I mean, yes, maybe the perception is not far off from the reality, but it does exist, and it bothers me that that's a thing. Like, that's a tool in your arsenal to, like, because whether there will be recidivism there or whatever, like, that should be taken into account. But it's just like, no, I'm just going to get this person off because some cop fucked up a form, or because of such and such thing or whatever, right? Like, I hate that shit.
In the context of what I was talking about before about a DUI, yes, technicalities can mean that a breath test will be suppressed. Technicalities can mean that, you know, you can fight it this certain way. But I think maybe what's missing from the perception is the reality is the sentence and the is ultimately going to be the same. The effect on the client, whether or not they have this technicality, most of the times the way DUIs resolve is somebody being evaluated by a state-certified agency, somebody agreeing to do a certain amount of treatment, whether that's a guilty verdict on a DUI or whether a technicality, quote-unquote, gets them a reduction down to reckless driving. The bottom line is, even if you have that technicality in your arsenal, more often than not, the jail won't be the same and the ignition interlock requirement won't be the same, but that requirement that this person have some form of accountability, attend AA meetings, go through treatment, right, which I think gets to maybe what you were talking about with the recidivism and how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again. It's not all that often, at least in my experience, maybe I'm just a crappy attorney, that a technicality means the case is outright dismissed and it just goes away. Usually the technicality helps you negotiate so that there is a fair resolution that will have some form of accountability, but will mean that your client doesn't have to spend 10 days in jail. It means your client doesn't have to have an ignition interlock device in their car for 10 days. It means that they're not going to have to
lose their job because they're in jail and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just you hope the people, the players involved have the same goals, but oftentimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
I've got clients who say, I cannot go to jail. You know, do whatever you have to do, but I can't go to jail. And it's not for me to say, you stole the bread or you hit your wife or something, you deserve to go to jail. That's not my role at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be able to do my job effectively if I had to start judging them privately before they went in front of the real judge. So it just to do my job effectively to ensure that their rights are protected, that's not something I think about.
Do you think you would ever come across a case where somebody can't, like let's say a domestic violence case, right, where this guy just kicks the shit out of his wife, and then he comes to you or whatever, like do you see a scenario where you're just like, you just tap out, you're just like, I want nothing to do with this because the guilt of this person and the act that they've done is so heinous to you that you would just be like, no, thank you?
So it's come up a couple times where I've had some really heinous stuff. I had a sex case involving allegations of a lot of rape of children. And that one gave me pause, but there's so many issues with the case too. Like, I just didn't think all the allegations were true, mm-hmm. but I felt it really important that we get to the truth of the matter. And ultimately mm-hmm. that case went to trial. So it wasn't like I was looking for the truth, but I was looking for it in the preparation of trial. So, you know, in an advocacy role. So, I kind of put the allegations aside just so I could do my job effectively, because I did think the person was getting railroaded a bit and I wanted to help them out. And I got another case, where it was just after my daughter was born, and it was allegations of severe child neglect. And that one, for real, gave me pause,
mm-hmm.
In a way that I had never encountered before in my career. And I was like, you know, there was babies involved and other children, and I was like, I don't know if I can you know, take this. And honestly, that happens for lawyers, that there is some trigger that they can't do the job effectively, and that's okay. Everyone's human.
Yeah.
And you just say, I can't do this effectively. This person deserves an effective representation. I'm just going to have another lawyer do this case. Because the thing is, you read these police reports, and they're always written in the most inflammatory,
sure.
The person is super guilty, there's no mitigating circumstances whatsoever. And then you start talking to people, and you learn the full facts, and you learn about their lives and things. And I don't know, maybe I'm a softie, but I always get some compassion when I hear about the struggles they've had. And so for this parenting one, you know, she needed services, and we were able to get her that. And she accepted some responsibility, and we got some charges dismissed and all that. And I think everyone was happy with the result. I think it was actually a situation where we did collaborate and get to the right result.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's bad for a lawyer to say, I'm in over my head emotionally or technically or whatever reason, say, I can't take this case. I think that's fine. I have come close to that, but it hasn't happened for me yet. But mm-hmm. It is something that I look at, and, you know, it's legitimate to say, for whatever reason, this case isn't for me.
Oh, yeah. No, I think, yeah, I'd like to see it more often, maybe.
Well, I do think if you're charged with a crime, you deserve a lawyer. You deserve somebody who knows the system. And the more egregious the crime, the more important it is to get effective attorney. Because we can't have a society where if you're accused of something really nasty, that means you're done with your rights. It twists on you. Like, the more severe the possible penalties are, you know, your reputation, jail, death maybe,
mm-hmm.
the more important it is that we make sure that all the rules are followed
sure.
stringently.
Yeah.
It's our second super heavy turn.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've touched on this a bit, and this is actually one of the topics I want to talk to you about. Let's say you have jury duty sometime, and you see somebody in the defendant chair,
mm-hmm.
not the lawyers, the actual person on trial.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said many times, almost like pathologically, that they've done something wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? They wouldn't be there unless they did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
How do you separate?
Oh, I'm a prosecutor's wet dream. Like, I would just have to balance. Like, when I would just go in and be like, I don't know, I'd wear a mind. I don't know what I would do. The equivalent of YouTube, like whoever is on that side of things, they'd suss me out real quick. I think they were like, no, we're going to get rid of this guy. I don't think I probably have any. I mean, depending on the case, right? Like if it was a domestic violence thing, or if it was a child thing or whatever, right? I have no business being on that jury, because like you're never going to sit there, Noah. You are never going to be in that position. Right? Like it's just de facto, like it's an impossibility for that to happen. So if this person's there, right, and I know this to be true of you and hundreds of other people that I know, right? And for him to be sitting there, like, why are you sitting here, bro? Like, what's your story? Like, why are you here in the first place? And so I would not be able to be partial in a case like that. Like it just wouldn't be able to happen. There's a difference between like, you know, going to the Target and lifting a few things because you're hungry, than like, you know, kicking the shit out of your 5-year-old every night when you get drunk. Like, those are two wildly different things.
I agree with you. And the stealing a loaf of bread is such an easy one. But there's things like addiction and things that lead to addiction, like drunk driving or stealing alcohol.
Sure.
You know, it gets, there's the real world has some shades of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I think you saying no friend of mine or people I know who would never be in that position, it's just not the case. Anybody can find themselves in that position.
Oh, I think there are some people I don't, you know, that I don't know, maybe they're just, that's what's up, right?
I think in the middle of a divorce, especially, accusations, whether it's of physical violence against a spouse or accusations of terrible things happening to the children,
mm-hmm.
are so easily thrown around that you might be surprised which of your friends could eventually be accused of something when shit hits the fan.
So you're saying that it will happen, maybe not often, but semi-regularly, that a person would just accuse somebody of something that they didn't do just to, like, be a pain in the ass or just to, like, cause thorns.
Well, it's not to cause suffering. It's to, like, get custody of the kid or get more money in the divorce.
Sure.
It happens.
But that shit's going to come out in the – I mean, that's going
to – But that doesn't change the fact the person's in the defendancy waiting
right.
for it to all come out in the wash.
Sure.
For 2.5 years when I was at the city attorney's office, I did exclusively domestic violence and child abuse cases. And it opened my eyes to how often – those accusations come up in literally in the middle of divorce proceedings.
Yeah.
That somebody who had 38 years of not being in contact with the law sort of suddenly has all of these terrible accusations being thrown against them.
It does happen.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think it's, it wasn't the majority of my cases, but it definitely is. People know how to abuse the system, and accusing a loved one of something terrible, whether it's violence against them or accusations of something they may have done against their children, has a significant impact in how custody proceedings happen. Mm-hmm. And people get real serious when they're worried about either division of assets or where their children are going to spend the rest of their lives after their divorce.
Yeah.
And it's all justified because the child can't spend time with this person. He's so terrible. You know, he cheated on me or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yes, it's an abuse of the system, but it's for the greater good. Things like that. People find themselves a defendant sometimes, you know, if they had a beer or two at dinner and they think they're fine to drive and then they're like, you know, 0.08, like right on the border. And there's some uncertainty with these breath machines, you know, sometimes it goes lower or higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I believe I wasn't drunk driving and I want to vindicate myself. And a jury comes up, you know, it's, there are instances. So let's say you were called for jury duty and you needed to be on the jury. How do you think people who believe if you're there, you're guilty of something? How do you reconcile that with like presumption of innocence and all the standards of our country? How can you make that mental shift?
You mean if I was required to? Like if I was...
If you're required to, or just giving advice to people who want to, you know, fulfill their civic duty. Obviously, you want to get out of it. You don't like contributing to society. You just like taking advantage of our resources without giving any back. That's fine.
That's right, yeah.
But for the people who do want to serve and be a good citizen, how can you help them, you know, not make the same mistakes you're making every second of your life?
Why are they coming to me advice for the first in the first place? That seems like a terrible decision.
Well, you're here with the microphone. You're strapped in, so we're just going to speak to them.
So I'm trying to give advice to someone to not think the way that I do.
Yeah. Think better.
Okay.
Can I ask a backup question before that, before he gets on the jury?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. I assumed always doing trial work that people wouldn't be as forthcoming as you have been today, which is fantastic. And you seem very confident and very secure in your beliefs about where the light shines and where the light doesn't shine. And that's great. But I think I've always just assumed that it's going to be difficult to actually pull that out, and that in a place like Seattle, which is where I've done most of my jury trials, it's a very white.
So you think there might be more people that are just like, you know, yeah, they're probably here for a reason, and then they're gonna tell you what you want to hear,
right? Because I think the being in that panel and being in that courtroom and having essentially a light shine on you can be a very intimidating process. And when you're in a room full of strangers and you're being asked these very personal probing questions,
right.
And it is actually the exact question that you laid out is something that I see a lot of defense attorneys ask. Who here assumes that because my client is sitting in this chair that he must have done something?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that question asked probably 50 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fairly rare for somebody in that context, when they're sitting with a room of, you know, 25 liberal, white, educated people staring at them, to have the courage to raise their hands and say, yeah, I do. And
well, you know, that's,
do you think,
I don't know that I would. Yeah, I'm not sure that I would raise my hand, honestly.
That scares me.
Like when
that
I think,
scares the hell out of me as a
defense attorney.
Sure,
sure. When I think about it, like, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not sure how I would react, honestly, but my knee-jerk reaction is to say that I probably would not have the conviction to raise my hand in that situation.
Let me just look at the defendant and go, psst, psst. Hey, you're done. The Coliseum, like,
curtains,
thumbs down.
I don't know. Because I think... it's a difference. There's a different thing between sitting here talking to you guys and being able to be a little free about that, and being there where the weight of the situation is kind of on you now, and you're like, oh, I actually have to be like impartial about this. Like, I have to be like,
turns their heads to look.
Everybody
at your
will judge you when you say.
They're,
I assume that.
You are the only one talking in a room full of people. Of course, we're looking.
Oh no, no. I think what had happened is actually I'd be like, I'd raise my hand. And then I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'd probably think that blah, 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 blah. And then you'd see, like, four other hands go up. And you'd be like, That worked? Oh, yeah, me too.
See,
me as well.
This is like common thing.
I'm going to get out of here.
This is a common thing where people
Let's
are like,
Chipotle.
I want to get out. Yeah, just take them out. Yeah, that's good. That people want to get out of jury duty. You know, it's just like this trope in the media.
Sure.
Like, how do I get out of jury duty?
Yeah.
You know, it was a 30 Rock thing and all that. But I do think a lot of the people...
It's because you get like $5 a day or something. It's not worth your time.
It's like 10. No, it's horrible. They should definitely up it.
Oh, it's double?
I think it's
Ooh. 10, but it costs $14 to park at the courthouse.
Yeah, plus you just lost a day's wages.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's terrible. It's a travesty how low jurors are paid.
Is there a community that tries to get like employers to mandatory pay people for days that they have to do jury duty?
Seems
like that should be a thing.
Some employers do it. So.
Well, yeah, Amazon does everything. But yeah. It seems like it should be a law where you're just like, we should have elections on Sunday or Saturday, and not Sunday, Sunday's football day. We should have elections on Saturday, and we should make it so the jurors get paid from their employers. Or the state pays them. State's got bucks.
State does. $12 a day, buddy.
I mean, I agree with you. And, you know, we have a minimum wage. Maybe we can do some kind of minimum jury pay from your
There is a, I don't know if it's a code, I don't know if it's a statute, but there is a requirement that you cannot be penalized by your employer. You
can't be fired.
For participating, you can't
yeah.
be fired. But there's nothing as of yet that requires an employer to actually pay the same wages that they would be for sitting around.
Oh, people would lose their minds if you tried to pass something like that.
But in answer to your earlier question, I do think people who go to jury duty generally, not all of them, do want to do the right thing, and they
right.
want to serve on a jury. And I told you about that case with the child and the sex allegations, and people were on the jury, and some of them did raise their hand and say, there's no way I can be fair and impartial in this case. I have personal history. I just think the allegations are too serious.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you are afraid, as Denise said, of some people lying in wait, and they're like the second, you know, the trial starts.
There's a big difference between, like, somebody standing up and saying, yeah, my uncle got to me when I was 5, I can't do this case, and me going like, nah, I just kind of think everyone's guilty. Like, they're going to judge me. They're not going to judge that person.
They're not going
right.
to judge them, but you still...
You're right.
But there are people, I think I've seen it before, where someone says, I'm pretty sure they're guilty of something, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, or something less, you know, overt, like, I don't believe police make mistakes. I think
mm-hmm.
they're always telling the truth, and
sure.
they always get it right, which is the same thing. Of course, they arrested him, so they got it right. And, you know, you deal with that.
Sure.
I think you're right. I think, how do we make it more comfortable for people to be honest about that stuff?
Well, I think that, I mean, you know, regardless of what I've said today, I feel like I would hope that I would be able to, and I mean, we're playing it up a little bit, right? I mean, but, you know, I would think that when I'm in that situation, I would just be able to be like, all right, well, I hear everything. Like, I'm not a moron, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I think I would be able to listen to all of the whatever stuff, you know, from both sides and be able to make a reasonable decision on that. I'm not just going to be like, you know.
We'll put a pin on the moron question for a second.
Sure, we can come back to that.
But, you know, I've known you for 11 years, and I've been a lawyer all that time, but when I started getting into the field and started getting into stuff, we'd have a lot of conversations about
yeah.
this subject and other stuff. Hey, how are you on talking with police right now? You answer their questions? You got nothing to hide, right? You're still good with that? Okay, great.
Well, no.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But,
my original assertion. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, I've seen you a lot. I've spent a lot of time with you. You're living in my house right now. We also have to put a pin in that one. But, like, I don't have the luxury.
You sound like a bum.
Yeah, I do. I don't have the luxury to...
Bum, moron, caveman.
Yeah.
God. Thanks for coming, by the way. It's really great to have you.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, yeah. Are you going to validate my parking?
You know, I had a guest on there. I gave him a little bit of a hard time, and I thought, it was too mean to him, but I guess I'm just going to triple up and just deal with you. Anyway.
Well, we're meaner to the ones we love, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
you got me all sidetracked.
Flustered.
Yeah.
Noah's flushing.
Love.
So hot.
Something way I thought before.
Oh, yeah.
I don't
have the luxury of having that much FaceTime with somebody to, like, get them to slowly shift their views on
right.
the justice system.
Sure.
Like, you're a special case because,
yeah.
you know, you're one of my best friends and I talk to
well,
you.
Well, you have. I mean, and we've talked about this, you know, before. Like,
yeah.
you have changed the way that I think about things. And, you know, as you were going through school, you know, we would talk about stuff and I felt my... And it's a proximity thing too, because like I noticed that like you know like if we don't talk for a while or whatever, then I just go back into the wind. And then if we're around, or being around is different than talking about this specifically, right? And then, so tomorrow my views will be different than they were yesterday, of course, but like, right? I think, you know, you have changed. So I went from, how do you feel about cops? And I'd just be like, doors open, come on in, search some shit. You want to look at my computer? You want to look at the drawers? You want to whatever? Like, I have nothing to hide, right? Because I'm just like, I don't have needles in the drawers, and I don't have, you know, child.
Personal question. There's like no porn on your computer?
There's porn.
Oh.
No. It's, I mean, you don't have to keep porn on your computer anymore. Like, if you search my history,
so
I guess it's different, right? But like, yeah, you don't keep it on the computer. I mean, it's all websites and stuff, right? And you don't pay for anything. Anybody who pays for porn is a fucking moron. But there's no like there's no kid stuff, right? So like there's no kid stuff. There's no like. This is a different topic if you want to go into
this. No, like, I'm just amused that
Zelfunders falls under the umbrella of being edited out.
This whole thing. I've got an hour of 28 minutes of content right now, and I've got like 5 minutes of valid airtime. It was funny to me because when I posted the episode with Denise, and you were like, man, Denise swears a lot. Wow, she's got a filthy, filthy mouth. She's such a cussy.
I'm the rube, though.
Holy shit, do you fucking swear so much?
she's the professional one.
You're a fucking moron if you pay for porn. That is Eric Reasoner selling you that.
Listeners,
I want that
to be your walk away today.
That's gonna be my liner notes.
Yeah. Here's your other walk away. when you pull into the parking lot and like you pull in, go to the stall in front. Don't just stop at the first stall. Slide into the next stall so that when you're leaving, you can just drive straight out and not have to back up. I hate, like, if there's
should,
a car in
we
front,
we should post
don't
this
worry
at
about
gas
it,
stations,
but,
too, because no one
yeah,
has gas
yeah,
stations.
Right. Oh, my God, it kills me. And get the fuck out of the left lane. Okay, anyway, so...
Five minutes, 30 seconds of
yeah, porn. Ah, so back to... okay, so my original... the way that I thought about this stuff was that, you know, I have nothing to hide. Like, and I'm not speaking to other people necessarily, although if you have nothing to hide, you should be fine too. But, like, I have nothing to hide, you know, so, like, if a cop is just like, Mr. Reasoner, come on in, you know, you want some tea? We got some donuts, like, what do you want? Russian tea cakes. So, you know, and, like, because I'm not guilty of anything. I have nothing. So the cops have no problem with me. We're golden. Right. And, you know, I would be after you going through school and us talking about just the, you know, the initial, interaction quite a bit, I would not be so gregarious, I guess, but like,
you can search.
But I'm taking
these tea cakes.
I'm not nervous, right? Like when I get pulled over by a cop, like even if I'm speeding or whatever, like I'm not just shaken to the core, right? Like a lot of people, like either legitimately or illegitimately, are. And I trust that the transaction is going to go fine. Yeah, maybe I'll get a speeding ticket, whatever, right? But I know that I don't have a dead body or, you know, like pounds of coke in the trunk, so I don't have to sweat that shit, right? It's a better way to live. But also, like, I mean, so before I'd just be like, yeah, knock yourself out, right? Like, now if a cop came to my door, I'd just be like, you know.
Better call
like,
a
do you have a, yeah. 1 second, please. I mean, they need to have a legit reason why they're there, right? And they need to show me something. Now, I know that I don't have to worry about that transaction still, right? Because I know that I don't have anything going on. But like, I would be more guarded, I think, than I would in the past.
So you gave me two thoughts. Well, one is going to be asking Denise how she feels about that. But the second is, when you get pulled over, we should have like a bundle, you know, wrapped in paper and wrapped in tape, and inside is just like 4 cans of Coca-Cola,
mm-hmm.
and they're like, you have anything in the trunk? Or actually, where? I'm like, I've got some Coke in the back. And they take out their switchblade and open it, and it's just like cans. Maybe it sprays in their face. That'd be pretty funny. Anyway, Denise, Erica said, as a white male who doesn't have a criminal record and dresses fine, that he's not afraid of the police when they pull him over. He might get a ticket. That's the worst that can happen. You've been pulled over recently for crazy
variety of things.
Crazy stuff.
Just so the listeners know,
a whole nother
yesterday, topic. Literally 24 hours ago, Noah helped me to get out of a speeding ticket that would have put my insurance rates, because I have another speeding ticket from 5 months ago and a not inconsequential accident I caused on my record about 2 months ago. So
I've never
listener out there, call Noah, because just yesterday he helped me get out of a ticket.
I never did ask why you drive so much faster when you have only toddlers in a car. You're just totally fine with just you and me, but when you have your kids in there, you're just like crazy. I don't understand it. But so you've been pulled over recently, so you know, you see those lights. How are you feeling? Are you feeling like this is the worst that can happen is a ticket, or am I feeling like I've got some stress, maybe it's irrational, but I've still got this spike of adrenaline, or I don't want to search my car, you know?
Oh, I would never let anybody search my car. It's probably part of my personality, but I'm just a, you know,
obstructionist.
Yeah, by nature. But I also, because of what I do, right, if I'm telling my clients, hey, you shouldn't talk to the cops, then I feel like I should live what I do. I also always feel like there's some sort of angle with every interaction I have with the cops now. Again, not because there actually is, just because it's my chip and it's my perception. So the ticket I got for speeding 6 or 7 months ago, I remember the officer said, you know, where are you headed so fast? And even a question like that that feels benign, my response is, I didn't feel like I was driving fast, officer. I'm not going to give anything because it's just a byproduct of what I do. It doesn't mean that I don't think that other people should have free conversations, but I understand why people are very nervous when they get pulled over. I wonder if you say that you've never been nervous during any interaction driving, I assume that means you've never had like a beer at happy hour and then jump behind the wheel of the car.
No, I mean, specifically to that thing, I think that if I'm pretty hard, you know, people think I'm a hardliner before, but on this topic specifically, there's no leniency as far as I'm concerned. Like if you get into the car and you're drunk and you drive, you're done.
Oh,
you never get to drive ever again.
But
the only time that has happened to me was, it was a long time ago. And, I was fine. My friend wasn't, and this is going to be embarrassing, but we get into his car, and he has a stick shift, and we decided that he was better drunk. Like, it was going to look less suspicious if he drove drunk than if I drove the stick shift home, right? So he drove, and it was...
This is why you will never be in a defendant seat, because it sounds like you just push your drunk friends or you push your deviant friends into
mind
control. Be like, I don't really want to drive home. Will you?
I did. Like, I was. We were going, and it was just like, this is awful. And then, so then we switched it up. We didn't. Yeah, I mean, it's indefensible, and we didn't go very far or whatever. But like, that was the only. That was the only time that I've been like close to a situation like that where something like that has happened. But I'm very, very conscious of that. Like, because I think that it's so immensely reckless to me, and it's such an easily preventable thing. It's just like, you know, stay at the bar for a while or stay at your friend's or, you know, take an Uber home and come back and get your car in the morning or whatever. Right. Like actually I was downtown with a friend of mine years ago. I left my car downtown. I took a cab back home. And then I came back down to Belltown to get my car. And the gay pride parade was that day, and it was just covered in shit. It was just like, it looked like an elephant had jizzed on it. It was just like covered in all this white stuff, like all over the place. Right. And
I'm going to edit my fingers to the bone.
I may be an idiot in other parts of my life, but I think that I do correctly. Cause I don't think we should have any tolerance for that behavior whatsoever.
The ticket that Noah helped get me out of was when I was driving home over the summer, driving about 80, but it was after happy hour, and I knew I was fine. I'd had one glass of wine. It was a 6-ounce pour, not a 4-ounce pour. again, I knew I was fine. We also had dinner. It was a 3-hour, meeting with a girlfriend.
You weren't very pregnant.
I was 6 weeks, 6 weeks along. It was no big deal.
Fine.
But even just that, I mean, being pulled over, knowing I was fine, knowing I'm being pulled over for no other reason than speeding, it caused me significant anxiety. I worried about, is there wine on my breath? Asks me, have you been drinking? What kind of response will you have? And I do feel like I'm the same with you, that I'm very diligent. I don't get behind the wheel of a car if I feel even the least bit impaired. But having read 1,742 police reports that start with, I approached the driver's side window, I could smell an obvious odor of intoxicants on the driver's breath, is how each and every one starts. So even though I felt fine...
You have to have been, like, soaking in a vat of booze for the cop to be able to walk up and, like smell it on you, with the window down? Like,
no. Well, first of all, this thing about smelling intoxicants is not something verifiable.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's no way that they could, like... Unless they just get right in there, right?
Well, sometimes they do, but they just will always say it. If they have a report that ends, I arrested you for DUI, it will start, I smell booze.
Right? Yeah.
Because that's kind of like a threshold question.
Sure.
Why are you sticking with this guy?
Yeah.
So it's just pro forma. Sometimes they smell it, I think sometimes they don't.
I don't do much. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, they will still start the report that way every time.
Yeah.
So you... don't commit crimes, you don't have contraband on you, and so cops have no concern for you?
I don't know. I mean, could look like somebody that went and did something. I don't know. I'm sure I'll do something at some point that will get me in trouble.
Oh, I'm going to ensure that you do, sir. I will be planting evidence.
Don't put your eyes on Denise. She hates that. She will charge you with reckless endangerment.
Oh, this is how you drum up business? You just run around and
planting
implicate
evidence,
people, and then,
right.
And then you're like,
rope-a-dope.
Oh, do you need help?
Exactly. Girls gotta do what a girl's gotta do.
I had this guy with this when I was a kid. I had this bully, and he picked me up one time. Like, he just like lifted me up and then like dropped me down like on his knee. So like the small of my back like hit his knee.
Bane and Batman.
Yeah, well, I mean, but not cracked across, but we were both vertical, and then he just like put me down on his knee like this, right? And it kind of hurt my back and stuff. And then and then I go home, and my dad's like, I wonder if his old man's a chiropractor. Like this was...
so, it was such a precise move.
He's like, oh, maybe he's drumming up business.
Son, when you're bullying those crackers from O'Queen, make sure you get the third thoracic vertebrae. That's really good money there.
Yeah. So this is his... So I think about that, it's a good way to run around and pick up business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, the cop that's also, like, a bartender, right? Can you get you one more?
Hey, Noah, whatever you do, don't edit that part out, because I want everyone to know, I want everyone to hear that I was... This
Oh, they
want to
hear my threat to
plant
evidence.
Okay, sure. But I'll let your request out.
I'll let you know you have, like, 3 weeks to do it, and then I'm out of here. So,
the country.
Anyway.
Oh,
we'll
that's
see,
right.
We'll
leaving.
See about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, dumb, dumb, dumb.
Yeah, so...
Can't leave the country with pending charges,
shop,
sir.
Shop.
Yeah. You can be out of jail, but you got to forfeit your passport.
Yep.
Oh, yeah?
That's the rule. Yeah.
Wait, you can't... If you go to jail, you have to forfeit your passport?
No. When you go in front of the judge, they'll say, we were not going to put bail on you, but you have to give us your passport so you don't flee the country.
Oh, I see. Interesting. I'm actually going today to apply for my Russian visa.
Hope that goes well.
Cross fingers, yeah.
Bring some vodka with you. Bring some money.
Are you going to go chat with Stalin? Confront him about the things?
Stalin? I mean, we could.
we'll
have a seance.
Is he the one in that
he's trying
glass
to look back
casket?
To Putin.
Who's the one in the glass coffin?
I don't know.
One of the Russian leaders is like preserved, right?
I think so, yeah.
Was it Stalin?
It might be.
Okay. So yeah, you
might
could go.
Cold.
You could hang out.
You could approach him.
I'll take a picture. We'll take a selfie.
Approach his corporeal form.
I'm sure there's statues all over the damn place, right?
Yeah. Who's in Fremont?
Lenin.
Lenin. Okay.
Yeah.
Go pray to Lenin, too, while you're down there. Get all your Russian ducks in a row.
Yeah. I'll go see if I can find Rasputin's remains.
Finish War and Peace, too, while you're at it?
No. I don't know why I've done all the other ones. Because
it's huge.
Yeah, but so is, like, Anna Karenina and Brothers Karamazov. Like, I've read those. I haven't read more.
Yeah. Should we wrap this up?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, seems like fun.
So, Eric, Denise, thank you both for coming in today. We had a good conversation. It didn't quite go in an orderly, unsweary fashion, but that's fine.
You can chop that all up, right?
Racial epithets got thrown around a bit more than I intended, but that's fine. That's fine. You can hear the final thing when it comes out. And I do appreciate you guys taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I love talking.
And yeah, this has been Know While. Signing off. So we're done. We can still say
that's not what I'm saying, and I knew you were gonna say that, and everyone listening to it is gonna be like blah 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 blah.
Thanks so much for just
shutting.
Just shut the fuck up, man.
I don't know what you want from me.
This is my intro.
Oh, this is the intro?
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, this is Know While.
The guests shouldn't speak before
that. Oh, my God.